present a man who is certainly not anonymous, but who is very well known, Dr. Green from Detroit Fellowship. Dr. Green, it's all yours.
Thank you, and good evening, folks. You don't need to be worried about squirming around on those chairs. I've sat out there myself, so I'm not going to bore you at great length. I had a lesson in that at one time when I talked to the prison group in Michigan, and these boys were pretty rough, and I noticed them. This was a captive audience. As they sat there squirming on their chairs, I began to get a little bit nervous, and the chairman leaned over to me and said, "Go ahead and make your pitch, Doc." He says, "They won't bother you. They're just looking for the SOB that asked you to talk." So some of you may feel that way before I finish. However, it's always a pleasure to me to talk about something. I think it is to anyone to talk about something that they know a little bit about. And I make that remark a little bit, because having treated several thousand alcoholics, I know less now than I did before. Just when the time was, the month or the year, the day, when I was overtaken by those four horsemen mentioned in the big book, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, I don't know. I don't believe in these blow-by-blow descriptions. Naturally, as your chairman said, I wouldn't be here unless I belonged to the most expensive initiation fee fraternity in the world. So I have been through the grinder. However, it is rather difficult for me at this time, having lectured a great deal to professional groups and medical societies, to give what is termed strictly an AA talk. I think I've rather been spoiled for that. And I just noticed picking up a pamphlet out there said, "We don't lecture." So you may be a little disappointed, because I look at this condition as an incurable disease. It's comparable to many of our low-grade chronic inflammatory diseases, with such an insidious onset that we don't recognize the early symptoms. By the time we begin to experience physical and mental pain, we have become afflicted with an incurable disease, just as we are with cancer, tuberculosis, and some of those other conditions. And it is hard for us to realize that there is something wrong. I think we all feel self-sufficient enough, and one terrific barrier to our doing something about our problem is something that I like to talk about, and that is a willpower model. We all have that in our minds, this problem of willpower, but we don't realize that we're dealing with a drug addiction. Some people don't like the term alcoholic. They sort of shy away from it. I didn't like it either. So in medical circles, we're using the word problem drinker. You know, it's a little more genteel. Same time, it brings a lot more into the fold. However, I'm a little more brutal than that. I tell these people they are drug addicts. Because we are dealing with a sedative drug, which we formerly thought was a stimulant drug, but which has no stimulative properties, but belongs in the classification of sedation. Now, we live today in a chemical world. Perhaps we always have. We depend upon chemicals. We breathe our air, for instance, oxygen. For our body chemistry, we have to use water. That is, we learn to use water after we've been in AA, which is essential. Food, our chemicals, everything about us is chemical. Were it not for these chemicals, we couldn't survive. Now, in regard to the concept of a poisonous chemical, all of these chemicals, which are very common, are poisonous in certain amounts and to certain people. Just why it is that some of us become afflicted with the disease and can't stand certain chemicals, I don't know. There are a lot of things we don't know about this disease. There's a tremendous amount of research work being done now in most of our large University, incidentally, which was all stimulated by the success and the publicity given to Alcoholics Anonymous. So we are beginning to learn some of the physiological factors concerned with alcoholism. We know that some people are more susceptible than others. We're so constructed physiologically and anatomically that our cell tissues will not handle alcohol as well as others do. So we point to the guy in the initial stages who, like Winston Churchill, is said to consume 2 quarts a day, a great statesman, a great orator, a great writer. 2 quarts a day. Didn't disturb him any. But you see, the answer to us is that we are not Winston Churchill. I am me, you are you. There are no two people alike in the world. The mold was broken when they made each of us. And the tremendous mathematical possibility that the combination of genes that determine our characteristics is so great that it's impossible to have two people exactly alike. However, I like to divide the human race into 2 classes as far as the consumption of alcoholic beverages is concerned. Those are the cans and the can'ts. It's just that simple. Now, we can't determine beforehand who these can'ts are going to be. Some of us are can'ts from the first drink we ever took. Others had to get this thing gradually, that is, attain a certain capacity, a certain tolerance, and then reach a point where we began to go downhill into oblivion, and our tolerance began to decrease. Of course, we have a great many theories about this thing, about this problem of alcoholism. One of the commonest believed by the public is that it's genetic or that it is hereditary. It is not, definitely not. Environmental, yes, partially, but there are so many other factors involved. A man, the entity of man, is quite a combination. He has a body, he has a mind, and he has a soul. Now, when we get sick with this drug addiction, we become sick in every department of our human entity. Of course, like all illnesses, the first thing we recognize is the physical distress, the shakes, the tremors, the upset stomach, and so forth. We recognize those things because they produce something called pain. And we go along for a considerable length of time before we begin to experience something that we do not recognize too easily, and that is psychic or mental pain, mental trauma. Oftentimes people come to us, and in their interrogation and taking their histories, they're very reticent about some factors in it, and they'll come up finally with some things. Now, nobody ever thought of this but me, so I must be pretty bad, especially with this idea of self-destruction, the paranoid tendency that often shows up with the alcoholic. Of course, every alcoholic becomes a schizo, split personality, a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde. No question about that. This drug does that. But they come up with some of these fantastic things, and nobody else ever thought of this until they get into AA and find out that these things are standard equipment. Now, you see the reason that many of you perhaps get tired of hearing these open meeting discussions and hear a speaker hold forth at great length about the episodes and the dates with various drunks. I don't remember the dates because my last one lasted 3 years. So that we don't know. However, there is something very definite that we do know. That we do experience both mental and psychic pain with very little thought of spiritual pain. We get away from that entirely. Many of us came to AA away from our youthful teachings. Many of us came to AA as agnostics. And some of us came thinking that inasmuch as we were regular attendants at church, that we were all right in the spirit. It was just our bodies and our minds that were weak. Now, when we're dealing with an addictive drug, we're playing with dynamite. Of course, the worst addictive drugs, naturally, the opium derivatives. And then come your goofballs or barbiturates. And then we put in alcohol. And now we have added another one, tranquilizers. In spite of the publicity given to their harmlessness, they are definitely addictive. We have many case records, and there's a great deal of research work being done on it, proving that they are addictive, and I know that they are because I've treated addiction to tranquilizers. Now, something begins to happen along the line here when we begin to get into trouble, and many of these we may call premonitory symptoms. They begin to appear gradually, and I think the first impact that our people are aware of is from a sociological standpoint. We begin to get into trouble in our families, with our wives or our parents, children, relatives. And they begin to notice that something isn't right because here is such a person who is such a wonderful, suave, nice, gentle person when he is sober, pleasant. And what a louse when he's drunk. Here is a definite splitting of the personality. And it's an interesting thing that oftentimes I've discovered that this is reversible. We take the extrovert, who is this jolly good fellow, and he gets drunk, and he's the fellow who wants to lick a cop. He's meaner than all get out. He's you take the shy fellow, you know, and he gets the same way. He wants to lick a cop. But this guy that is really belligerent, normally, he gets a few drinks and he's laughing, he's gentle as a lamb. There's no prediction about this alcoholic problem. However, let me repeat, as we continue to drink, certain things begin to happen. Now, some people, I've had this brought to me many times, I'm too young to be in AA. Well, it might help you to know that we have case records of delirium tremens at the age of 8. So you're never too young. However, this is readily explainable, this age element, because we, inasmuch as we have varied tolerances, we begin to get into trouble at different ages. Some people are confirmed alcoholics. We've done a lot of research in Michigan and teenage drinking, and it's amazing the number of alcoholics we find in high school and the college level, teenagers. Now, some of us go along and it doesn't seem to interfere with our work or our lives or our families or even our economic status for a considerable length of time until it gets so serious that these little symptoms or characteristics begin to creep in. And they are so definite that they form a pattern so exact that we can call this thing a disease because we have a set of symptoms, just as measles or whooping cough or some of these other diseases, so that we can separate them and put them in a pigeonhole and give them a name. And so we can with alcoholism. When we begin to get into serious trouble, of course, the initial stage is we become liars. Every alcoholic's a liar. You don't like that, but it's true. It includes me. Now, why is this? Because there is one pronounced feature that distinguishes man from the lower animals. And that is something that our blessed Lord gave us called intellect. And this is a definite anatomical tissue in the brain that gives us the ability to think and to reason. Therefore, man has to find a reason for everything he does. If he goes fishing, there's a reason for it. Goes to work, there's a reason for it. Does something, there's a reason why he does this thing. When he begins to get into difficulty with his drinking, he finds gradually he doesn't have any real legitimate reason, so he begins to make them. And so begins to develop a beautiful alibi system. And if you want to hear alibis, learn how to shoot angles, talk to an alcoholic. He knows them all. I've heard alibis that if I had them written down would fill this room. I thought I knew them all, but every once in a while I hear a fresh one. Also, there's something else begins to happen to us when we begin this alibi. This is lying, you see, and we're getting into this web. But something else begins to happen. People are amazed when I stand before them, especially medical society, and tell them alcoholics don't drink. They don't. They gulp. It's got to hit the tonsils down the hatch. Not after the taste. We don't take a shot, hold it up to the light, and admire the color, and sniff the bouquet, and put a couple of drops on your tongue, and roll it around. We are after a physiological chemical reaction. We want to bang the result. So we also begin to sneak drinks because we're ashamed, you know. I wonder if some of you occasionally in your own home when you were all alone, nobody around at all, went out into the kitchen or down the basement, carefully looked around, got the bottle. Trying to cheat ourselves, to fool ourselves. Not only other people, but ourselves. Then, of course, comes a time when something definitely has happened, and we don't realize it right away, when I seem to have lost control. I go to a party with my wife, and she'll caution me now. Take it easy, for goodness sake. Don't make a fool of yourself. Just drink like the other people do. I wind up stiff. Why? Because something has snapped. I have lost control of my drinking. And once I get my beak in the beaker, it's in there till I'm saturated. This thing goes on, and then we begin to experiment. We begin to think there's something wrong. We begin to think that we're terrible sinners. And some of us kind of get religious. I'll go back to church. That'll take care of it. I went to church twice. Didn't do any good, so I didn't go anywhere. Then we begin to experience some other things come along. We get some nasty hangovers, and we call our family doctor, and we lie to him. Bronchitis. And says, we've got a whiskey cough. You don't fool him. You think you do. You know, and getting them into the hospital was practically impossible. Many a patient I've got into a hospital with a fake diagnosis. Had a nurse come around afterward, the head nurse or the intern. How's your drunk getting along, Doc? You don't fool these people. We hit the hospitals. I've had people have been in the hospital as many times as Heinz has got for pickles. With no help. Then we begin to experience some definite physical symptoms. We begin to develop a tremor. I don't mean the gross shakes you got with a hangover, but a very fine tremor, and this is often more characteristic around the facial muscles. When a person is relaxed and there's no tension, perfectly calm, but the minute there's a little bit of tension, you see this around the facial muscles begin to quiver. Fingers begin to quiver. This is a manifestation of beginning nervous system damage. Don't let anybody fool you. These nervous system damages are not all a result of malnutrition. We know that an alcoholic doesn't eat a good diet, a balanced diet. He's getting too many calories from alcohol and so suffers some of the diseases of malnutrition, such as pellagra. You know, we see symptoms. That's different. That's simple. I can explain that to you, the symptoms of pellagra. We call it the three Ds. Diarrhea, dermatitis, dementia. I add another D, death, because it's inevitable. Now then, as these things begin to appear, we definitely begin to get some psychic changes. And we become, all of us, overwhelmed with fear. Nameless fears and anxiety. I don't know what I'm afraid of, but I had to go to bed every night drunk before. because I was afraid. Afraid to shut my eyes and afraid to open them in the morning. Afraid of what? I don't know. Those terrible, terrific nightmares, which are in reality hallucinations. Definite disturbance of the nervous system due to a physiological disturbance in our body cells. You see, there's something else involved more than just the mind in this drinking business. That is evidenced by the fact that when we have a patient in the hospital who has been a heavy drinker and we suddenly withdraw his booze, unless we use counteractive measures, he's very likely to have delirium tremens or hallucinations or convulsions. We can head those off fairly well now. But it's a terrific shock to the nervous system. And I feel that my body cells were so accustomed to their daily bath of alcohol that they wouldn't function without it. I couldn't write my name unless I had a couple of jolts. I couldn't talk without stammering. And I couldn't even think unless I was half-lit. The morning drink is common, of course, with all of us. But none of us have to have all of these symptoms before we can be termed an alcoholic. One reason I really don't like that term, because I've never heard a good definition of it. I've heard hundreds of them. I think best I like is the use, addiction to a sedative drug that gives us a welcome effect and a temporary escape from reality. And that is why we drink. Now, if we want one basic reason why we drink, it is because of something called euphoria, which is purely escape from reality. This is a stage that we go through with an either anesthesia, the first stage of anesthesia, and that's what we do. Now, in drinking, I like to compare to this drinking with the administration of ether, and we look at this brain of ours as a series of lights, electric lights, the intellect being the top, and then the emotions and so on, the muscular activity, so down to the vital areas of the brain. And when we start to drink, we start putting those lights out from the top down. And the first top light being most sensitive, the intellect, goes out immediately. And our emotions, which are more primitive, take over. And that's why we behave as we do. Free rein to our emotions. They become something that we like. This gives us a pleasant reaction. I'll do as I please. Now, that is not normal human behavior. The normal human behavior is with the intellect taking charge of those emotions, because that must happen in order that we may get along in some degree of harmony with our fellow man, with our families. But when the bull gets out of the pasture, emotions running wild. And this is insanity. So we become creatures of our emotions, a great big ball of emotions. So that by the time the psychiatrist sees us, if we seek the help of a psychiatrist, he says, this man is crazy. So put him in a booby hatch and turn the key on him. Now, they have reason for their belief that alcoholism is based on a neurosis or a borderline psychosis, because when he sees us, we're nutty as a fruitcake. However, I believe thoroughly, I don't believe this at all, because we have many men in AA, many people, I cover women too when I use the term man, who have achieved success in their various fields, whether it be in the home, the office, politics, or whatnot, or business. And then when old John caught up with them, things began to happen. We point to some of our great writers, some of our great writers in the past, some of our poets. What beautiful work. And they were alcoholics. But when the history is determined, we find that their greatest work was produced before John Barleycorn caught up with them. And then their work began to deteriorate. This happens. It is inevitable. Certain things are inevitable in this drinking thing. And even those who have gone along for a long time kicking it around they live long enough, inevitably, it's going to catch up with them and can't miss. Because this human structure of ours will stand so much. We build up a tension. And we keep building these tensions up until they reach a point where something has to explode, something has to give, so we get drunk. We found a way out. A drug that is cheap, that we can get anywhere, don't have to have a prescription for it, and produces the desired result. Euphoria, temporary escape. I don't worry about my business, my family, or my children, whether they have bread or shoes, when I'm drunk. When these psychic symptoms begin to appear, we're in trouble, bad trouble. Now, in spite of what the psychiatrists say, of course, I'm always feuding with them anyway, although I use a great deal of psychiatry myself, don't agree with everything. They use a lot of big words, and you know you can find psychiatry. Don't be afraid of it, folks, because it comes out of the good book from Job and the Psalms, the Gospels, the letters of St. Paul. Well, that's where psychiatry comes from, based on it. But I think this, that inasmuch as many of these people have achieved success, a degree of success in their chosen fields of work, what definitely happens is that we suffer a retrogression or a throwback so that our behavior then does become childlike and infantile. And our thinking is childish, our excuses are childish, our alibis are childish, and we act like a child. Our feelings are so easily hurt. It's peculiar how sensitive an alcoholic becomes, feeling stuck out all over him like the quills on a porcupine, just waiting for someone to touch one so he can have his feelings hurt. Also, a great theory of theirs is a childhood frustration. The reason you're an alcoholic, somebody stole my little red wagon when I was a little boy, and I didn't like it. That's why I'm an alcoholic. Well, of all the poppycock. Now, here I will tell you something, however, that if your alcoholism is based on a psychosis, if you are nuts to begin with, and we sober you up in AA, you're still going to be nuts. We can't do the impossible. But we never know, because I have seen people who I was willing to have committed, and when they had become dried out and stayed sober for a considerable length of time, they were perfectly normal. Now, here's something that I want to interject, because I find this so often come up among people who approach AA and come to AA, and they come to a few meetings, and AA doesn't work. We have spent a considerable length of time building up these resentments in our minds, building up this hate so that we literally hate ourselves. We have spent a considerable length of time damaging ourselves, our body cells, and our nervous system. And we get sober, and I want to be perfectly normal right now because I haven't had a drink for a week. It will not happen. You must be patient because it's going to take anywhere from 18 months to 2 or 3 years before we begin to become anywhere near emotionally stabilized. You're not going to obtain a serenity. Of course, when I was in a few weeks, I wondered what these guys had been in 2 years. When I was in 2 years, I wondered what took them 5 to get. When I was in 5, I wondered what that took 10 to get, and so on. Now I wish I had what Bill Wilson had. Now here I think, too, perhaps may be an unfortunate thing. I'll get to that a little bit later. But here, when we hit a period, when we are in the depths of despair, we make up our minds in a moment of truth to do something about it. But unfortunately for us, a pattern habit of the alcoholic is procrastination. I will do it on my birthday, on New Year's, or on my wedding anniversary, but I got Christmas holidays coming up, or a party coming up, so I'll do it after a while. We continue to procrastinate until the disease gets a firmer grip and the addiction becomes more violent. Now, this is addiction. Let me emphasize this because I know that there is actual cell craving for alcohol. The body demands it when you become accustomed to it. Not only psychic, but physical and physiological. Your body chemistry becomes adjusted to functioning in the presence of alcohol and won't function without it. That's true of any sedative drug. Of course, what it does, to interject something again, it interferes with the ability of the body's cells to make use of available oxygen. Now then, when this thing goes on and we begin to reach this despair, what are we going to do? Well, we'll try this. Everybody's preaching this willpower model to us. Why don't you be a man? Well, I often like to think of a man that my wife used to hold up to me as the golden model. A pillar of the church, president of our community organization. I live in a little exclusive community in Detroit, North Rosedale Park. And this was the man that I should model myself at. So much to my glee, the gendarmes collected this guy one day for getting his fingers in the till where they didn't belong. And I said, now that, see, I drink a little, but I don't steal. So we can find more excuses and more alibis, and Carter's got pills. But there comes a time when we reach this moment of decision. Now, some of us decide, I'm licked, so I'm just going to keep on drinking. Nothing I can do about it. Now, there are others who will quit for a little while, but they still feel that they're getting some compensation from their drinking, so they're going to fiddle around and, like some of our boys in AA, get drunk every 6 months because they had some reservation. I think we all do when we came in. Maybe someday I can drink like a white man. However, we find out some different things. Then we may decide to do something about it and where to turn. Now, as we know, let's not be so naive as to believe that we are the only people who help an alcoholic. There are many agencies that have had some degree of success, but I don't think anything in comparison to what AA has had. Some of them, I think, are a little jealous of AA. However, there is something that seems to keep us back. I know my initial acquaintance with AA was when I read Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post, carefully hid the magazine so it couldn't be found. But I knew that my behavior was not right. I knew that my mind was not functioning normally, and I knew that my body chemistry wasn't functioning normally for sure. So I decided I would do something eventually, that this would be a fine thing for some of my patients and my barfly friends, especially the moochers. But eventually there came a time when I started getting trained, early training for the holidays. You've all done that, I think. And come Christmas Eve, I settled down for the week in my basement with a whiskey bottle. Nobody around but me. I was left alone in a great big house. And there came to me something, not that Bill would like Bill Wilson experience, but there came to me a moment of truth. When I sat opposite myself in spirit and examined myself mentally, auto psychoanalysis, if you will, as I would examine a patient. Now, this is something I learned later in AA. We call inventory, I think, the most poorly discussed part of the program because we fear it. We don't like it. And I didn't like what I found. I found a quivering mass of protoplasm, who I thought had prostituted his profession, who wasn't fulfilling the destiny for which he had been trained. I found an individual who is incapable of the truth, who was vicious when he drank, and it became so rotten that I came up with an answer. The only outlet for me is self-destruction, because I am not worth anything to anyone on this earth. So I conned over in my mind the various methods, and of course, being a physician, I knew many easy ways, but I came up with that great and glorious idea, especially brilliant, that I think most alcoholics do: I'll drink myself to death. Now, I've been trying to do this. So I proceeded to follow on for the next week, and after the new year, I got to thinking again during a moment of sobriety. You know what's funny about drinking? Only another alcoholic will understand this. But at times when you're drinking, your mind will work with clearness, quickly, rapidly, and the thoughts will spin through your mind. And then you'll go on to coma again. But it was during one of these periods, I think, when I had a moment of truth again. I said, I've got to do something. This was during the war, and doctors were badly needed. They weren't any use sitting on a bar stool. So I decided I would do something. I called up my father, who was a very saintly man, and said, Dad, come on out the house. I'd like to talk to you. He came out. He says, well, son, you were raised in a religious family. Have you tried prayer? I said, don't give me that bunk. I envy you your faith in God. My father was a saintly man, Christian 7 days a week. I said, I have been scientifically trained. There is no such thing as a God, because if there were, he wouldn't let me suffer like I'm suffering. He wouldn't let me suffer this mental torture that I'm suffering. And I said, furthermore, I have dared your God to strike me dead. Nothing happened. I prayed for death and nothing happened. There can't be any such animal. Now, I think we all go through a phase when we don't recognize that here indeed we have cancer. Cancer of the soul. Cancer of the soul. I believe this thoroughly. I decided to take matters into my own hands with a typical egocentricity, selfishness of the alcoholic. I will handle this myself. I've always handled everything. I'll handle this. So I put myself in the sanitarium. An interesting sidelight on that was the fact that while we were discussing it, my wife was sitting over in the corner. You know how they look. And I said, Dad, well, I think I better go to the sanitarium. I think I can get my affairs in shape in about a week so I can get away. My ever-loving headache said, what affairs you got left to get in shape, and how right she was. So we compromised. The next morning I was on the train. And I missed the connections intensely in Chicago because I was getting sobered up. And if I was going to an institution, I wanted to give them a little something to work on, you know. Be no doubt in their minds. I spent a couple of days on Clark Street. The time I got there, I was in good shape, all right. But I found there something that I wanted. I experienced physical rehabilitation. In the meantime, sometime before this, I had written to AA and had received no answer. We didn't have a very active thing in Detroit then, very large, I mean. So my letter got fouled up. When I got home, I was anxious to get back to work, and I was just prancing, so eager and so happy, because my mind was working again. I was able to think. I could eat. I could sign my name, and I could talk without stuttering. was pretty busy in the office. You know, the word gets around. Everybody knows you're a lush, and everybody knows by the same token when you sober up. And I think the word must have been passed around by some of my patients. The old doctor's sober. You better get up there and see him before he pitches one. Because I did have a pretty good reputation as an internist. So I was awfully busy, and I hadn't been home very long. And something began to happen. Some guy had called me up about AA, and I said, look, save this. That's for the birds. Don't talk to me about it. I handle this myself. I don't need you people. Oh, we'd like to help. I don't need any help. I handle this myself. Now, I like to emphasize this because, you see, I was just as screwy and drunk as I was when I went away. My thinking. One night I went to my office. I shared a waiting room, a large waiting room, as large as this room, with another internist and a dentist. I had a couple of weeks, a couple of days, evening off, sorry, and I peeked in the back door, hoping that there was no one there for me, and the office was packed, and they were all for me. So I hustled in, took off my coat, said, I'm going to run a little test on that cure tonight. On the way home, I'll have a double. Well, maybe two. But that'll be all. I won't have to have any more tomorrow morning. I know how to handle this stuff now. Looking back at this particular evening, and I shall never forget it as long as I live, I began to mull this over in my mind. I took care of two patients and then a third. Suddenly, I excused myself from this third patient, went in the back room. Reached for the telephone and called up this man whom I'd reviled and said, where is this AA you speak of? I want to come. I didn't recognize it at the time, but here was a spiritual experience, definitely an answer to the prayers of that saintly father of mine. So I went to the meeting, and it was on a Thursday night. And they were having coffee. Meeting was over time I got there. But I saw a couple of graduates of the institution from which I had recently graduated. And they told me they had been there, graduated summa cum laude, and had a little trouble after they got out. But they said, now, this is Thursday. We have what we call a discussion meeting on Tuesday night. Doctor, try to stay sober. I said, hell, I've been sober for 3 months. I can stay sober till Tuesday, but you know, it wasn't any trouble. It never occurred to me to take a drink during that weekend. But I went to the meeting. Again, I was late, and they were sitting around tables, and of course, I was foxy. I got right near the door where if I didn't like it, get out. But I became interested. But they were talking about something that didn't interest me. They were talking about the second step of their program, about God. The third step, rather. So I said to myself, well, here's another branch of the Salvation Army. I'll smarten these guys up because I saw it was going to get around to me. I had read everything I could find on alcoholism. I had treated it in our large city hospital, treated delirium tremens, convulsions, hallucinations, whatnot. I'm going to give these monkeys some scientific facts. I'm going to wake these yokels up. I'll let them know that I am an expert on alcoholism. Now, when it came my turn, here again was a spiritual experience that I didn't recognize till much later. Because the words that I was going to utter did not come out of my mouth at all. How they came out, I don't know. But I said, gentlemen, I know nothing of this thing you call a program. I come here humbly as a student to learn. You see how fortunate I was, because our blessed Lord at that very moment handed me the key that opened the door to success in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, humility. No more big shot. I must sublimate that divine ego of mine, which I thought was divine, and become humble. I learned that I had to be honest, as I had been honest with myself in that basement. An absolute intellectual honesty. We don't have a concept of honesty. We think as long as we pay our bills and I won't steal your purse, I'm honest. No, that's only a part of honesty. Honesty in tangible things. But I must stop lying to myself and to others. I must think clearly with purity to the point. And if I were intellectually honest and looked at the record, I would be forever humble. And I often do that because it produces humility. We know that this program was founded on the Oxford movement. And we used to talk of those things a great deal when I first came to AA. Which are the fundamentals on which every religion is founded? So simple. Intellectual honesty. Unselfishness, and we had become the most selfish and introverted and lonesome people in the world, lonesome in a crowded room. Purity. Well, say, that's for the angels. No, we mean purity of thought, even in our physical condition, our mental hygiene, and our physical hygiene. And last of all, love. Now, we don't have a concept oftentimes of these words. Love to us usually means something of a physical nature. Love of sweethearts, of husbands and wives, of parents for children, children for parents. That is what we mean in AA. I think the clergy will agree with me. There's a word in the Old Testament called agape, which probably expresses what we mean by love in AA, or the love expressed by Plato. Love of our fellow man. Love somebody else beside me. To give instead of take. We've been on the receiving and the gimme end, even when we first come into AA. We start to learn to pray again. We got the gimmies. Gimme this, gimme that, gimme that. Give me something else. Not thy will be done. We utter that without knowing its meaning, without realizing its meaning. Not my will. I did a very poor job in a driver's seat. Now I'm turning the ball over to a better halfback than I am. A power greater than myself. And man throughout eternity has always been reaching for something he didn't understand. A concept of the soul. Each of us, perhaps in his own way, has his individual concept of this power. But we know that it exists because we have the evidence. We have to have proof of these things, and we have the evidence every time I go to a meeting and see these miracles sitting around me and see them performing as the instruments of this divine power. I know that there is a God. There must be. Divine guidance. I, like many others, complained bitterly in my early days in AA that I had trouble with the spiritual part of the program. And it was right before my face all the time. And for 7 years or 6.5 years, every Sunday, I used this same text in my discussion or my talks at our hospital when I always talked about the spiritual part of the program. And my text was so simple. We came to believe. We came to believe. It's unfortunate for most of us, perhaps, that our founder, Bill, had this sudden hallucinatory experience, and we sit around, I sat around waiting for that to happen to me, and it didn't happen. But gradually it came. And this didn't come too easily. They advise us to do some spiritual reading every morning, some meditation, to ask for guidance through the day, and not forget gratitude at night for having had a sober day. Factors. Had to do it about every hour in the beginning. We learned our serenity prayer. One booklet we used to read was called The Upper Room. It had a little thought for the day, a couple of paragraphs, a little story applicable to some religious principle. And it had a little prayer for the day. And then at the bottom, in numerals, hieroglyphics, was a Bible reference. After we get sober, we become so industrious in the pursuit of that God, whose picture is on a piece of green paper with a one up in the corner, a five or a ten, that we forget from whence our sobriety came. We don't have time to look up the Bible reference, so one morning I looked it up out of curiosity. And it referred me to something that has made a profound impression on me, which I shall always use, and I never talk to an AA group without mentioning it. And that was the 116th Psalm, which is a song of gratitude. And the psalmist describes himself as an alcoholic. He said he was in trouble. He was brought low. And the pains of hell got hold of him. And then he called on the name of the Lord. And the Lord inclined his ear and listened, dried his eyes from tears, delivered his soul from hell, and kept his feet from falling. And I discovered, too, as I progressed in AA and continued to attend my meetings, that something had happened to me in my life that people told me about before I began to recognize it in myself, a personality change. And I can thank only, not me, not my own effort, but that divine mystery, the mercy, the graciousness of our blessed Lord. I feel sincerely, paraphrase Henley, no matter how straight the gate, how charged with destiny the scroll, our Lord has opened a gate for me that no man can close. Thank you and God bless you.